I'm here with Irena Lara Silva, the poet, the fiction writer, and the philosopher. And I think you've been on the show. How many times have you been on this show? It's been, you know, it's always nice to have you back because we always have great conversations.
I think this is the fifth or sixth, which is so much fun because, like, for such a long time, I wanted to be on it. And now you can't get me off the show.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I used to tease Juan Felipe Herrera because when he was on the show the fourth time, I says, now you are part of the four timers club, and we're going to get you a special coat or a hat or something. And, but you've even beat Juan Felipe.
Wow. That's crazy.
Well, it's good to see you again. For you and the listeners, you must know that I'm with my daughter, Lucinda, right now. And so if you hear that voice that you just heard, we're not going to edit it out. We're just going to let it be, you know, let the children come to us, right? Like exactly. The difference between a Mexican wedding and mainstream wedding is they have to quiet the kids at the mainstream weddings. They don't want them to talk. But at Mexican gatherings, man, the kids just run all over them. And they just, you know, contribute to the whole spirit of it. So I hope you don't mind, Irena.
I don't mind at all. In fact, you just reminded me of an old memory. I think the first time I got tipsy, I was actually around 10. And
really?
We went to a wedding in Corpus. And it was a Mexicana, you know, Mexican-American marrying somebody white. And I think the only kids were the Mexican kids. Uh-huh. And I don't think anybody warned us that the punch had been spiked.
Oh, my God.
And so there were all these kids just running around all crazy. And then, of course, they all just took a nap after a while. That was that was the first time. It was very fancy. I think it was also, it was interesting because I remember that they brought in a mariachi. And I don't think the white people were prepared for a mariachi because they weren't Texas white people. And then the Mexicans weren't prepared because they didn't serve a dinner. Instead, they just had a buffet table with like sugared grapes and little hors d'oeuvres and things like that. And wow. So you could, you know, thinking about it afterwards, there really was like a clash of cultures at that wedding.
Yeah. You know, my wife and I have very similar backgrounds. She's a Chicana from here, from El Paso, and I'm from Fresno, but, what shocks her and even kind of still shocks me is when you get a wedding invitation and it says no children allowed. That's just weird.
It is. It's very strange. You know, you take them everywhere. Quinceañera, a party, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Kids are still there. You know, you just
do a recording on Words on a Wire. You take
them. You have a backyard barbecue. You bring the kids, you know, you just have the kids running around.
You know, and it's, you know, what I learned is, you know, and I'm sure you know this too, and a lot of people know this, is that it's not just a Mexican thing, but like I go to Madrid a lot. In fact, I'm going again this summer, taking some students there. I love Madrid. It's a great city. But you can be walking around at 3 a.m. and there's still families out there with their kids running around. You know? And a lot of times when people who come from the U.S., they'll say, how could they do that? How could they let their kids run around and blah, blah, blah. But they're always with family and they're always safe. I was trying to figure out before I talked to you, I lost track of how many books you published. I know it's quite a few and you seem to always be publishing one a year or something like that. So how many is it now?
It isn't. And I've noticed that I start to feel this crazy sense of, you know, if 3 years go by without a new book,
it's like this,
it's this gnawing, clawing, like hunger, lack of something inside of me, which is what I tell people after a while. Like after you write the first one, it's just sometimes it's this addiction that like takes hold, or like you need a new one. And so I'm kind of coming up on that where I need a new one. But let me see, I have one collection of short stories that's going to hit. I think it just hit its 9th birthday, and I'm almost done with the second one. So I still need a couple more stories on that one. Mm-hmm. And then there's 4 collections of poetry, and I've just started working on another one. So, you know, that's always what makes me be like, okay, I'm ready to finish this one. I've got to move on to the next one.
You know, I'm going to evoke Juan Felipe Herrera again, because His thing is when he just started coming out with book after book after book after book. And he frankly didn't care if they were perfect. And he told me this one time. I had this collection I was working on at the time, and he had read it. And he said, send it out. And I go, well, I don't think it's ready yet. And he goes, I don't care. Just send it out. You can do another one after that. And there is something behind that philosophy, because I know a lot of writers might, you know, go the extreme, the other way, to the extreme, to where they don't want to put anything out unless it's absolutely perfect. And then they do put it out, and of course it's not perfect.
Yeah. You
know? And so I think there is some value to just getting the book out there and then going on to the next one, you know, and don't take yourself too seriously. But at the same time, obviously you don't want to put crap out there. You want to do your best, and then, you know, you do your best, and then you move on and you leave that behind.
Yeah, there's got to be a happy medium, because, like, you know, you always hear about the writers that are like, oh, I hated my first book. I'm so embarrassed. I'm ashamed of it. And it's like, well, you know, at that time, like I think back to the first book, I'm like, at that time, that was what I meant to say. That's the way I meant to say it. Right. And that was the best that I could say it at that time.
Wow. You know? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't even read my old books. I tried sometimes, and I just thought, no, I can't do that. Because, you know, a bunch of feelings come out.
I'm still okay with most of them. In fact, it was interesting. I recently, I had an essay that just came out in a brand new anthology from University of New Mexico Press.
I have a copy of this right here. I was going to talk about this, that Teenex Poetics, Essays on the Art of Poetry.
So I wrote that essay in 2011 or 2012.
Uh-huh.
And really, I didn't touch it much between then and now. And so I recently reread it because I thought, well, I need to get ready. You know, we're going to be doing several different readings and interviews and stuff like that. And so I thought, okay, let me go back and reread the essay and see if I still agreed with it. And I was pleasantly surprised. And I was like, okay, I can still get behind this. Yeah.
Nice. You know, I loved it. I loved it. And it's called, I've been reading it. And it's called La Desembocada. And tell us what that refers to.
So the Desembocada is the mouth of the river. Literally. But if you take the word apart, it almost seems to suggest the act of unmouthing something that is feminine.
Yeah.
And so I love both the idea of the mouth of the river. And then I love the idea of this sort of like almost like coming out of yourself, you know, and almost to unmouth yourself. Like, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean as a writer? To unmouth yourself. And then the essay, you know, a lot of what I had wanted to talk about was just how we look at what's a good way to say this? We're often, not that we're fixated, but the quote that you always hear from Monsaldúa is about the border being a wound,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's always bleeding. And that's true, but it's also other things. And I think people also always, when they think about Ansaldúa's work, they always frame it, or they base it, that the foundation is always pain, wounds, and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the Mundo Zulu conference, which is a conference that Society for the Study of Blood Ansaldúa does. They had theirs the first weekend of November in San Antonio this year. And Ana Luis Keating, who is the main, you know, editor of her work, you know, before and after she passed, was talking about the idea of the cenote. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I posed to her was, you know, we do hear so much about Ansaldúa in relation to pain, wound, trauma. I wanted to know, you know, what would this talk look like if instead of starting with that foundation, we started with all the things that Ansaldúa loved? Because, you know, I mean, you know, from reading Borderlands, you know, from reading, you know, the New Mestiza Consciousness and a lot of her work, that there was so much love in her work.
Right.
I mean, there was love for people. There was love for women. There was love of languages and mixed languages, love of culture, love of mixed cultures, love of indigeneity, you know, to the extent that some people accuse her of appropriation. But it was this desire to love and to claim and to reclaim and to, you know, create connection. I mean, a lot of the work she did with you know, This Bridge Called My Back, and with other anthologies that she did. I mean, it was putting women from different communities together.
Right.
You know, and I feel sometimes that gets lost, because either as Latinos, as Chicanos, Mexican Americans, or maybe it's because there is so much pain that needs to get articulated. Like we only look at Ansaldúa through those lens, right, instead of looking at what she loved. So anyway, so 10 years ago, I didn't have that language to talk about Ansaldúa, but that's what I had wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about the possibilities of the border.
Yeah.
And then for me, you know, talking about water and rivers, like to me, that naturally leads to Lorca, because when I read the play of the Duende, you know, the play in theory of the Duende, that completely blew me away. And every time I reread it, I just have to sit in contemplation for a while.
Yeah. No, I love that essay. Yeah, absolutely. And it grew out of a speech that he actually did in Buenos Aires, mm-hmm, for the first time. And what's really interesting is I used to go to Buenos Aires a lot, and that essay was one of the reasons why I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And it was almost as if, and I was young and romantic and probably stupid, but my idea was, I'm going to go to Buenos Aires and I'm going to find Duende. I'm going to find the spirit of Lorca, you know, in Buenos Aires as opposed to in Spain, right? But yeah, I love that essay. One of the things that you mentioned is the cenote. And the cenote seems to be a theme, an image that comes back over and over again in your work and your conversations. Can you talk a little bit about the cenote and what it means to you and what it is?
I could see that, but I'm trying to figure out if I've ever talked about that.
You have with me. I don't know if you've done it in your work or not, but I know that whenever I hear the word, I associate it with the conversation we had. Maybe I don't even remember what it was, but.
And it's the cover image on the anthology I edited with Dan Vera that Aunt Lou published, mm-hmm, the Imani Man anthology. That's the cover photo is a cenote.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting because, again, you know, most people, when they talk about cenotes, they talk about it kind of almost in this Jungian sense, like the collective unconsciousness, like the dark womb belly kind of.
But what is cenote? Is it like a sinkhole, right?
Yes. Although there's some really beautiful ones in Mexico that have a water and you see light coming through and they're very gorgeous. But it's interesting. I actually, about 2 weeks ago or so, I had lunch with Sara Ramirez, who teaches at Texas State.
Uh-huh.
And she was talking about, hopefully I'm not saying anything I shouldn't say. but she was talking about the cenote as love.
Wow.
And I thought, that's so interesting, like, to, you know, to take all these ideas of what we think of as dark or dangerous or unknown. And of course, you know, in mainstream culture, unknown is always the dark and the dangerous. But to instead frame it as love. Love and possibility. And so I think in that sense, maybe my work keeps coming back very, you know, kind of in some ways, maybe tangentially or just sort of, you know, sideways. This idea of where do we have to go to be able to transform?
Mm.
Because you can't really do it, you know, in the outer, you know, in the outer world, you know, the expectations of who we are, how other people read us, the roles we take on in society or family or work or whatever else, all these things keep hemming us in. So then where does the real work of transformation happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that has to be the internal, that has to be the inner.
You are listening to A Conversation in the Writer's Cove. If you want to hear the extended version of this, you can go to wordsonawire.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Now let's get back to the conversation. Please, continue.
No, I just think that's more of where the second set of stories that I'm doing now has to go. Because the first set of stories had a lot to do with survival, was just surviving difficult things, whether they were, you know, historical or violent or whatever they were, but was surviving difficult things. So the second set of stories, I wanted to focus more on the transformative aspects. Mm-hmm. What do you have to do even when it's completely invisible to others to transform yourself in a real way on the inside? Whether or not that transformation is ignited by an external crisis or an internal crisis, any kind of crisis.
Well, you know, now that I think about the cenote, I remember years ago, Arte Público Press, I think it was, came out with this book called The Fabulous Sinkhole by Jesus Salvador Treviño, mm-hmm. who I think is also a filmmaker, if I'm not mistaken, a screenwriter. But the central story was this community, and there was a sinkhole, and it kept swallowing everything, and the community, mm-hmm. I haven't read it in 20, 30 years. I mean, I don't remember exactly, but I remember that being kind of a central metaphor image. You mentioned Jung and the archetype, the collective unconscious, and those sinkholes, you can't help but put some sort of meaning to it. And maybe that meaning really resonates with the Latinx community on the border, because I'm thinking about every now and then you hear about a sinkhole, and it's usually somewhere on the border in a Mexican community. And now, and this, I'm just remembering this now, my grandmother in her backyard had a sinkhole. It was an amazing hole that she would just throw a bunch of stuff down and it never filled up. And I remember as kids, you know, looking into it and throwing things in and just like, where did it go? You know, and then another connection is Tomas Rivera's "And the Earth Did Not Devour Him," you know, and it's all this, you know, it's really kind of a beautiful image of this, that like maybe even the mouth of the earth just, you know, sucking things in. I don't know, but it's
and the thing too about like how tenuous life and survival and our realities are. You know, the people want to have this idea that, you know, that we can schedule everything and that we know what's going to happen and we can predict and we can count on things. But if you come from, you know, a history or reality where you can't even depend on the earth being solid, you know, you can't depend on things not just falling through. And you know, and that also, I mean, that works for poverty. Like, you never know, you're going to end up evicted or without food or without clothes or without gas, you know, without a job. If you live in a place where violence or weather, you know, hurricanes or whatever else can just sweep away your entire town or your neighborhood, you know, and completely just devastate your life. This is not a conversation that I think I was trying to have a conversation, but you know, sometimes you want to bring something up, but you're afraid you're going to scare the other person. Mm-hmm. You won't scare. So I can tell you about this. But I had started to write a poem. And part of what I was trying to write about was how rarely in life becomes a blank page. You know, usually we've got a setup, we've got other things we're doing. Things don't just wipe out. Mm-hmm. It's very rare for that to happen. For me, that happened a few months ago. When my brother passed away, I was his caregiver. He lived with me for almost 20 years. My life became a blank page. I didn't know when to eat. I didn't know when to sleep because everything was based around his schedule. I ended up in the hospital 2 days after he passed, and I was in the hospital for 3 days at super severe risk of a stroke or a heart attack because my blood pressure was 265 over 221, which, as you know, is insane. I didn't even know that was possible. So they kept me there long enough to get it down and to run all kinds of tests. And they figured out my brain and my heart were fine. Nothing was abnormal. They were okay. They just had to get the numbers under control. I personally think that what happened was that my body short-circuited. You know, it was a combination of broken heart and my body finally realizing it could rest. Wow. And so I think I just short-circuited. But it was... I think good to be in the hospital because for those 3 days that I was in the hospital, I was surrounded by beige walls, beige bed, I didn't have to make any decisions. They fed me, they gave me medication, they tested me, I went where I was told.
Wow.
And I had to start rebuilding from that beige room what my life was going to look like, what I was going to do from day to day. I mean, to the point where I really felt like I was having to decide minute to minute what I was going to do next. Because I didn't have his needs to schedule my day around.
Right.
Or his meals or his sleep or conversation or hanging out or, you know, you live with somebody and you consult the other person. What are we going to eat? What are we going to watch? What are we going to do? What are we going to do for the holidays? Who, you know, who are we going to invite over? Like everything is a conversation. And then suddenly nothing.
Wow.
And then on top of that, my brother had been really important to my writing. I mean, even it wasn't even 5 weeks before he passed. He gave me feedback on the last poem that I wrote before he passed. This poem that I wrote for Uvalde, that's in Texas Highways magazine. And he's the one that gave me feedback on the last lines to the point where, like, I don't even remember what the original lines were. I just remember he said that it sounded cliche, I had to get back to work on it. And I did. And I really loved what came out of it after that. But he was so central to my writing that I'm just barely learning now. It's been, you know, it's almost 5 months. And I'm barely learning now how to get back to writing.
Wow.
But anyway, but yeah, so what I had wanted to say was, you know, what happens to our lives and to our writing and to our possibilities to transform when you do get that moment of a blank page in your life, you know, that happens so rarely.
Right.
Unless, you know, you come from a culture or a place or from poverty where you have some experience with just devastating things happening to you. And you have to rebuild.
Right.
You have to keep on going. You have to make something new. You go to a new country, you build a new house, you start a new career, you just do things. Because you have to. I mean, there's nothing else. My mother would always say, I have no idea how you say this in English, that with certain people, se les cierra el mundo. Like it's literally the world closes to them. Like they don't see any possibilities. And she would always say this in such, and either it was a very bad thing for somebody to be like that, or it would explain a tragedy. You know, if somebody committed suicide, if somebody, you know, died of a broken heart, of some whatever it was. So it was either, you know, se les cierra el mundo and they couldn't go on in a tragic way, or they could have thought of other things to do, pero se les cerró el mundo and then they didn't do anything.
Right. They stay in the beige forever.
Yeah.
You know, and they're attended on by their habits and their, you know, neural circuitry that they've had all their lives without seeing anything different. I think that transition seemed like it was really important. And it also evokes for me the idea that I guess it could be rooted in, you know, Buddhism, the idea that the source of suffering is the, you know, not being willing to change. And when you're faced with a blank page where your life is just completely, suddenly the structure is gone, everything is just suddenly gone. When you're faced with that blank page, you could do one of two things. You could suffer, and there is going to be a transitional beige period where there is going to be suffering, but yeah. you can continue to suffer and let your world get smaller and smaller, or like your mom said, let the world close to you, or you could write on that blank page and start a new story. And that sounds like kind of what you're doing.
and it was an interesting question that Dagoberto Gil posed to me, and actually I ended up writing a poem about it. I believe if I'm not paraphrasing badly, it was something like, is there any freedom that comes without loss? Mm-hmm. Which I've been thinking about a lot. Somebody was telling me they were envying my freedom to suddenly, you know, travel again and do different things and run around.
And you got a car. You have a car now.
I have a car now after 11 years of not having a car. You know, suddenly there's, you know, time has opened up, and I'm still working my full-time job, but I am 1 year, 9 months, and 10 days away from retiring. So I'm counting down.
That is gorgeous.
And then I will be free for real. But I was saying, you know, yes, I have this freedom now to decide, you know, other than the 40-hour week job, other than that, I have the freedom to decide a lot of things now, you know, especially when, you know, loved my brother, but there was a lot of responsibility, a lot of doctor's visits, a lot of, you know, he was a diabetic amputee. And so there was a lot of caregiving involved. But anyway, so this friend was telling me how much she envied my freedom and the ability to do things and write and travel and so on and so on. And I said, well, don't envy me so hard. You know, remember that I'm only this free now because I lost the person I love most in the world.
Right.
You know, so it's freedom and it's transformation that's informed and shaped by loss.
Right.
But that doesn't make it any less beautiful. And it doesn't make it any less transformative.
Right.
You know, and I don't know. And it leaves me thinking about, you know, how we lock ourselves into thinking that we can't transform. I mean, really seriously, at the beginning of all of this, probably the first 2, maybe even 3 months, after he passed, I wasn't sure if this was reality. I was like, is this life reality now?
Right.
And was the last 20 years a dream? Or was the last 20 years real? And this is a dream. And it could, because it felt so, now it feels more solid.
Right.
But I, you know, you are left wondering whether it's in, because of Buddhist learnings or of other, how actually conscious we can remain of the potential to transform and how conscious we can remain of how transitory everything is.
Right.